Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Bend a Table, a monthly food subscription service for avid home cooks focused on delicious and sustainable pantry items. Learn more at bendatable.com. That's BENTOTABLE.com. And when you use code HRN for a new subscription, you get $20 off, and we at HRN get 10 bucks. Hello and welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live from my house in Manhattan, where Nastassia is somewhere. Where the hell are you now?
I'm in Connecticut.
You're in Connecticut. Matt's in Rhode Island. John, you're in the wherever in the hell, what is that? Murray Hill. And there's nobody in Brushwick. No one in Brooklyn. We are a Brooklyn free. What? Yeah,
just zombies and Bushwick.
We are now a Bushwick free show for the duration of the corona. Yeah.
I do feel cleaner than usual.
Wow. A lot of harshness on the so I guess, you know, Matt, what you're talking about. And by the way, we have Nastassia Lopez as usual. How you doing, Stas?
Good.
We got Matt in the booth, although someone pointed out you're no longer in a booth unless you have a booth in Rhode Island.
I refer to this place as a booth.
Well, where are you really, though?
I'm in an attic, but it's a nice, it's not like the dingy attic that you're imagining. It's a finished attic.
All right. And you put on pants for the show, I hope. This is
did my first 2 hours in my bathrobe and pajamas, but I did put on pants and a shirt for the show right now. Still wearing slippers, though.
Right. We are a family friendly and also a chony free show. So we are not recording. We treat the audience as though we respect them. We put on clothes to talk to them. Right? I mean, in general, I hope.
In general.
Stas can't co-sign, so she must be still in her in her nighttime outfit. Okay. And I think the first time on the show, we have the new Booker & Dax customer service representative, John Newhall. How you doing, John? How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
So now, if you have a problem with a Booker & Dax piece of equipment,
it's his fault.
Well, it's not his fault, but it's our fault, but he's going to solve it going forward. So you want to tell them a little something about your background there, John?
Yeah, I originally started out as a French major, art history minor in undergrad, went on to work in kitchens here in New York City. I've been doing that for about 11 years now. During that time, I also went to grad school, where I got my master's degree in art history and focused on food and art, the relationship between the two, and then worked at the University of Connecticut for a couple of years as a professor and curator of the museum there, then worked at MOFAD as the culinary operations manager and curator, and unfortunately things are...
Very lucrative.
Yeah. Sean. Loaded.
Filthy lucre. So speaking of food-related art, So went back when I was in art school and just beforehand, when I was graduating from college. So I graduated college in 93, went to art school from 95 to 97. And this was kind of the sweet spot for kind of body image related art and also kind of, nouveau relativism in the New York art scene at the time. And so what do you think about that era of food art? I always kind of like, it was never my thingamajig. So, but as a specialist in the field, what are your thoughts? So like what was,
My research was a little more intense than just looking at that. It was I took a really intense philosophical perspective, looking at a lot of Kant and Hume, because they, back in the 18th century, set up these notions of standards of taste when looking at art. And so I use that dual notion of taste to look at food as well and show how certain types of cuisine or certain dishes could fit into the realm of what they call art, that it makes you think Yeah.
Well, first of all, Kant is a word you want to pronounce very carefully when you're speaking on the radio.
Okay, K-A-N-T.
Yeah, yeah. And then, secondly, like, are you the other person on Earth who's read Kant's Critique of Judgment? Because it's the weirdest view of art and aesthetics that you could possibly imagine. And anyone who says, I like Kant, I'm like, what about how crazy his views of aesthetics are? They're freaking nuts. Am I wrong about this? I mean, for those of you that don't know, Kant was a weird dude. I believe he's the one that had a giant head. He was a weird looking dude and a weird dude. And he didn't travel more than, I think, 3 or 4 or 5 miles from his house because he had all sorts of strange mental issues. Now, I've told, like, my cousin James, who is a firm believer in not looking outside of the text of a work to get information about the text. He hates whenever I do this, whenever I harp on someone's kind of personal, like, mental attributes to discuss what's going on in their text. But especially for someone who is such a, like, a crazy, I mean, he's no Hegel. I mean, you can read Kant, right? But I mean, Kant also, you know, let's just say he's not always the clearest with his writings. And so, you know, I am a big believer in saying, okay, yeah, let's take the text for what it is, but let's look at what an extreme nut job the person was in real life as well. You know what I mean? And so Kant, right, who is never leaving, you know, more than a couple of hours or a couple of miles from his house because, among other things, it might make you late for appointments, right? Like, I mean, complete wingding lunatic, has this idea of aesthetics whereby beauty and aesthetics are pleasure that you can derive from something like completely removed from your personal interest in it, right? And so he has this notion of the beautiful and the sublime, which are frankly nuts, right? So then, especially if you're going to try to tie that in with food, which is an inherently kind of personal need and personal enjoyment thing, like, so I presume that you were kind of anti-Kantian, or did you somehow try to thread that needle?
I didn't really take a stance on his sanity or his positions on things. I more just accepted that they were gibbons in the art historical record, and that I chose those two philosophers specifically, again, because of notions of taste, but also because their writings have shaped art history a lot in terms of, like, establishing what is beautiful and aesthetically pleasing and all that kind of stuff. And so I just wanted to show that using their own arguments, when they have said that food cannot be art, but using new cuisine, like specifically Fran Adria, that his dishes could fit within their criteria for what is called art.
All right,
so I wasn't passing judgment on their stuff. It was more just trying to fit this stuff within their body of work.
So just to be clear, you're basically backhand complimenting Ferran Adria by saying that his work is best enjoyed with no personal attachment to whether you get something out of it or not? Wow! Bang! This is the craziest, most crazy, like, over-the-top, erudite, backhanded compliment of Ferran Adria that I've ever heard in my life. Ever in my life!
Great. Glad I could make that
benchmark.
All right, so now, okay.
So what you're doing tonight at 5:30. So, yeah, so, John, it's at 5:30, right?
Yes, tonight at 5:30 on the MoFad Instagram account, Dave will be joining in and making his Cliff Old Fashioned cocktail on there. He's going to be demoing it and speaking with Sari, the public programs manager over at the museum. And yeah, just chatting with Dave and watching him put together a cocktail while we're all under quarantine. Yeah, it's technically called MoFad Happy Hour, but Dave's been referring to it as the unhappy hour.
Yeah. I mean, come on, let's be honest. Can't we be honest?
Like, hey, everybody, it was Dave's birthday yesterday.
Happy birthday. Happy
birthday, Dave. 49, another year closer to the box. Listen, going back to the Cliff Old Fashioned, one last thing about Kant's Critique of Judgment. Please read the Cliff Notes. Don't bother, like, unless you're a scholar, like, trying to wade through that, especially if you're not, like, already, like, well-versed in, like, the Critique of Pure Reason. Like, the Critique of Judgment is not something you want to dive headlong into, I'd say. What do you think there, John?
I'd agree. There is one professor out at San Diego Mesa College, Dwight Furrow, who is really able to break it down in a very explainable way, especially.
Yeah, I mean, all right. So, like, tune into him and read that if you're interested in weird freak shows ideas of what is beautiful and sublime. Now back to the museum thing. So, what am I going to do? I'm going to get on Instagram Live and make a cocktail, and then I'm going to, like, drink it.
Yeah, and talk with Sari. I think she's going to have some questions for you and talk to you about the cocktail and why you do certain things the way you do.
why I do certain things the way I do. Yeah. All right. Okay.
Yeah, it'll be straightforward. Right. It'll be fun. Should be fun.
Okay. Sure. Yeah. All right. So we got some questions in. By the way, you can't listen live, so you can't hear me. But if you listened last week, you can put things in live to the chat room, and Matt can read them. Matt can read them on the air. So with this we have in. Dear Dave, this is from Monty in Jacksonville. I burned my slash. So I think what Monty means is cuts down a bunch of stuff off of his property, puts them in a pile, and then burns it. So I burned my slash and can end up with a cone of coals 2 feet high, which is awesome, and 5 or 6 feet in diameter. So a good thing of coals here. I often throw root vegetables in a Dutch oven and roast them up. I haven't done that with meat, though, as it seems that the iron will get too hot and would burn the meat. Ideas for using this massive amount of heat without the work of turning a spit. Monty from Jacksonville. So I don't know. What do you think, John? You ever cooked with big coals?
I haven't. It's something that I'd really like to do more of, though. So yeah, don't feel. I don't know. Maybe just like, yeah, go for it.
The thing is that you might just want to wait for the coals to kind of burn down. You know what I'm saying? Like it's almost like if you could prepare this stuff ahead of time, you would burn it in a pit, kind of move it aside, put it in and bury it, and use the retained heat from the fact that you heated the hell out of the ground. You know what I mean? Like that's how like a lot of like the large scale like animal things work, is they basically treat the entire earth as a retained heat masonry oven, right? And you just burn the heck out of it and then sweep the stuff aside and then bury it and let the carryover do it, right? So like all of your initial high heat browning stuff's happening at the beginning, and then it kind of goes through. But I've never actually done it myself. You know, I don't know whether you'd have to like bury thermocouples in it or to test or whatnot, or whether you just don't care whether or not it gets a little overcooked. But what do you think, John? You think something like that would work?
Yeah, I think that'd work too. And frankly, I would also just try putting the coals right on the like underneath the Dutch oven and on top of them, like separate from the rest of the fire, so it's a little bit more controlled and tempered. But I know, you know, I've seen online videos of people cooking hunks of meat and things like that. I know one of the modernist cuisine photographs is a Dutch oven cut in half with like a pork rack in there, and they've got the coals on the top and coals on the bottom as well. So there's definitely some information out there.
Most people's Dutch ovens nowadays, modern Dutch ovens, are not the Dutch ovens of old, right? So if you look at like an old school, like a camp oven, right? Specifically, it's the lid that's, first of all, like they're all enameled now. They're all fancy, right? They're fancified. But as opposed to the old straight cast iron ones that are just cast iron in and out, no enamel. But also the old style. So if you look at the, you know, the Creuset, right, the lid on those things, if you were to pour liquid on the top of those, they would just stream off, right? But an old school camp oven has a lip on the lid that goes around. And the purpose of that lip is to hold coal, right? So that you can actually adjust the upper heat and the bottom heat. And there's a book out of Australia whose main thing is cooking. I forget the name of it. It's something like Dampers, which is an Australian like camp biscuit. And anyway, something like that. And it's about cooking in the outback in camp ovens. I forget the name. I have it somewhere. I'll try to locate it. Maybe put it on, send it to Matt so he can put it up on the thing here. But there's a whole bunch of recipes in there on how to cook with a camp oven. But by and large, And if you read, and I have all these books as well, if you read the kind of late 19th century, very early 20th century American camp literature, right, which was all based around based around rich white city men, right, hiring large amounts of often brown people to take them into the quote unquote woods, hack down giant amounts of trees and like build crazy camps in the forest, like 3 or 4 or 5 hours outside of where they lived. Right. So now it seems gross, but the technical literature of it is great on like building camps, like large scale camps like this, is that they would build massive fires, but then most of the cooking was done on a smaller scale fire that they pull off. And the same is true in the Australian camp book. So a lot of that Dutch oven cooking, you would pull stuff off of your fire and then use it on the Dutch oven all the way around. And meat cooking works great in that as well. I just don't have a lot of experience with it personally. What do you think?
I would also say to look at some restaurants, you know, that do a lot of wood fire cooking. And then also, while I don't like him too much, Francis Mallmann, you know, he does a lot of work with that stuff as well.
And if you don't want to turn a spit, right, but you have a really high tripod, you could do the tripod rotating string action and have it kind of self-rotate, but the top of it will always be under. So you'd have to flip it halfway between, but you could get that kind of rotation action or get it on the side. You know what I'm talking about, guys? The tripod with the string. Yeah. Or, you know, you could do what they used to do back in the old days, which is get a dog and have a dog running in a wheel, you know, the spit dog. And then, you know, the dog just sits there running like a hamster in a wheel, turning the, and I've been on the site. So Nastasia poked fun at me for a pilot that I did once. Remember this, Nastasia?
Time machine.
Yeah. And one of the things that they were testing was spit dogs. And I believe, my memory serves me, they actually had a dog in a large hamster wheel turning a spit. I think they actually did it, but I can't remember. If anyone has any experience taking, I guess what would you use? Like a sled dog kind of a dog? I mean, you wouldn't want something so furry because it's near a fire, but you'd need something that wants you to sit there and run. What do you, like a terrier? What do you, hold a piece of meat in front of the wheel and have it keep trying to get the meat? What do you do? No one? No one suggestions?
Your guess is as good as mine.
Do I have to have all the suggestions? You guys can't give me anything?
I can't believe that in this trail or in the pilot for this episode, they would have actually tried that. That sounds...
Well, no, they shot the whole first episode. They shot the whole first episode.
And how did you have to come out, Dave?
I forget. I don't even remember. Oh, no, I didn't come out of the fridge. The chefs came out of it. There was a fridge. There was a refrigerator time machine, and it had like the electric effects like you get from Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, which, by the way, is a great movie. Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure is a great movie. I'm going to go ahead and say that it ranks right. So I'm not one of these like Kino come lately fans. Like, I've been a fan of Keanu Reeves for like a long time. All right. And I'm going to say it's right up there with Speed and the John Wick series. I'm going to go ahead and say, and you know, which is saying a lot. Are you guys all Keanu Reeves fans or no?
No.
No? What do you?
I enjoyed the hell out of the John Wick movies. They're stupid and they're great for just, you know, mindless violence. I love it.
What about Bill and Ted's?
I mean, Bill and Ted's is great.
All right.
Yeah. No. I mean, also like The Matrix, that was the movie.
I even forgot about The Matrix. I forgot about The Matrix. No, anyway, Bill and Ted, right up there. Whatever happened to the other guy? What did he end up doing? I know what happened to George Carlin. He died, right? Anyway, a whole generation, my generation, learned history from Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. Anyway, John's not weighing in. John, not a fan of Bill and Ted.
I haven't seen it. I think, you know, not too familiar with Keanu Reeves' body of work. I can say The Matrix, but other than that, not too familiar.
What?
Yeah.
What about Point Break?
Haven't seen it.
Like, Nastasia, how could you not be a fan?
I just don't like him. I don't like him.
I mean,
him.
You're like, you had coffee with the guy and you were like, this guy's an a-hole. And that was it?
I feel like you have to either like him or Nicolas Cage. And you can't.
Whoa. I love Nicolas. I love Nicolas Cage. Well, now listen,
you are a white male in his late 40s, so of course you like both.
Well, you just said you can't like both.
Oh, the rest
you
of the
just world. Said you your words. I'm not supposed to like both. Not my words, your words. And then you're like, well, of course you like both.
Yes, you're not supposed to like both.
How am I not? Why would you not? On what planet? First of all, if Nicolas Cage had never done another movie after Raising Arizona, he'd still be great. Because Raising Arizona is like one of the all-time classic movies. Holly Hunter and freaking John Goodman and Nicolas Cage and Randall Tex Cobb, the ex-boxer, as the lone rider of the apocalypse. I mean, doesn't get much better in like an early Coen Brothers
movie. You're not going to credit the baby by name?
I don't know the baby's name. Do you?
Oh, not much of a super fan then.
No, I didn't say it was a super fan. I just said it was a great movie. I'm not, you know, I ain't nobody's super fan, Matt. Anyway. All right, so we answered Monty's question from Jacksonville. Alexander Mann on the chat room last time was like, hey guys, wanted to revisit my question for Dave or anyone else that might know. I've got barrel-aged tallow-washed bourbon. So here's the thing. So you tallow-wash the bourbon and then re-barrel-aged it. That's what I'm getting out of this, right? That I'm making and using for burnt end bourbon cocktails. I'd like to use a hot poker for those hot caramelized flavors. I'm currently using the pan method, but it doesn't work as quickly, and I'd like to make smaller batches. Any direction for where I can get a hot poker for home use? No. listen. Okay, so if there's no acid in it, you can do it the old school way, which is go on McMaster Car, look for a soldering copper, right? And get a big one that's, I don't remember the size, but ours were at least like an inch and a half around. They're big, right? Long, heavy. Keep those suckers on the fire for a long, long, long time, like on a very hot fire for a long time. And then use those. Now, anything with acid in it, you're going to get a little bit of kind of that sucking on a penny taste. But in a non-acidic environment, especially if you season it by using it a bunch first for a while, it works. And that's what I used to use before I started building the hot pokers. But if you're going to build a hot poker, like unless you get the exact one, which what are they? 4-inch, 500-watt, Watlow cartridge heaters. Weld them on to the end of a stainless steel stick. I mean, it's kind of hard to get it right in a way that's going to constantly light it on fire. But if you don't think you need to light it on fire, you can try with a soldering copper. I would not use – I've tested slugs of stainless steel. They're no good. I've tested slugs of iron. They tasted terrible. I've tested a bunch of stuff. I've also used spiral heaters. They work. The problem with making a red hot poker is an electric one is that especially if you want something to catch on fire, it's a very fine balancing act because with the repeated in and out and the fact that you need it to heat up relatively quickly, it's hard to do accurate temperature control at those very high temperatures. And at those very high temperatures that you need for spontaneous ignition, if you overshoot by 100 degrees, you burn out your elements very quickly. And so that's the kind of an issue that you run into. So you try to get a heating element that can just barely heat up to the right temperature in free air, right? And then you use that. But it's a balancing act. It took me a while to get it right. So good luck with it. And remember, personal health, danger, yada, yada, et cetera, et cetera.
We did have one other person from the chat weigh in. It's really just more of a response than a question. Wally said, thanks for thinking about my oven steam quest. I used a silicone hose from the Instant Pot pressure weight nipple to a stainless steel drinking straw inside the oven. I may drill a hole in the side of the oven to mount the straw as the hose is crushed by the oven door seal. Great crust and a bit more spring. Worth the effort.
Cool. Nice. And speaking of steam and oven spring, that is the kind of the crux of Jim Leahy's Dutch oven bread, no knead bread thing. It's like there's two things. There's the one is that you don't need to knead it if you're going to let it rise for a long, long, long time, right? which he does for like 24 hours. And the second aspect of that is he cooks it in the Dutch oven or in a heavy pot so that you're trapping the steam next to the bread for the initial part of the cook. So I didn't mention that during the steam conversion, but that's, you know, there's really two magical parts to Leahy's bread recipe. Are we going to get him back on again, Stas, or what?
We're thinking about doing a Instagram Live with him, the next Instagram Live.
Okay. But then can we get three people on an Instagram Live?
Boyfriends. But we are trying to find another system to include him. Or you and him can go at it. I don't know.
I don't know. All right.
Let's take a break real quick here and then come back.
All right. We'll be right back with Cooking Issues. This episode is brought to you by Bend to Table, a monthly food subscription service for avid home cooks focused on delicious and sustainable pantry items. Today, we're going to talk about the Essentials Box. Ben sent me one here. It says, ding dong, it's Ben. It's got a picture of half of his face on it. All right, we got Community Greens pasta. Now, I've heard good things about Community Greens, but I've never actually tried it myself. Here we have a hard white winter wheat. Anyway, it looks good. I'm anxious to try it. Rancho Gordo, by the way, bunch of Rancho Gordo beans. We got some Scarlet Runner beans. And then the one that I'm frankly most excited about is the Geechee Boy Mill Stuff out of Charleston, South Carolina. We have here some Jimmy Red grits. So Jimmy Red is a variety of corn, delicious. The grits from this are, and I've made these because I bought it when I was in Charleston, brought it home with me, cooked it, gave it to my wife who grew up most of the time young in the South, and she was like, damn, them's good grits. And it's all kind of nice, easy to use, you know, not something that you're gonna have to make crazy recipes to get to use, all just very high quality products that are in the realm of what you would use in staples for a pantry. Start your monthly subscription at bendtotable.com. That's BENTOTABLE.com. Use the discount code HRN to get $20 off a new subscription, and Bend to Table will donate $10 to support Cooking Issues and all of HRN's programming. Ayman Akdemir wrote in and said, hello, I'm studying philosophy in Istanbul, but recently I spent most of the time trying to develop a simple and delicious drink for kids and for the millions of diabetics in my country. I'm working on a sugar-free lemonade, which is sweetened with stevia leaves instead of stevia extract or any other natural or artificial sweetener. But the stevia is a tricky plant. It contains a sweetness that comes along with a heavy licorice taste. I would say poison taste. When brewed. Until now, we have achieved the best taste when simply cold brew with lemon peels and approximately 2 grams per liter of Paraguayan stevia leaves for about 7 to 8 hours in the fridge with a splash of lemon juice. During my research, I came across Liquid Intelligence, and I wondered if you have any ideas on how to improve the taste and preserve the drink without sacrificing taste. All right. So one of the issues on preserving lemon, and this is something that I'm going to talk about the lemon first. Like, I personally don't like stevia. I think it tastes poisonous.
Yes.
Yeah. John, what do you think about stevia?
Yeah, not great.
Matt?
Not great.
Never intentionally consumed stevia.
What?
Haven't you had it in drinks?
I don't. What drink? Like, what? Why? Why would I have had that?
Listen.
Stevia.
Matt in the booth is secretly a liar. I want everyone to know this, that Matt in the booth lies constantly. Just constant.
Wait, what?
Liar.
So what he drinks have I had that would have stevia?
I don't know. How do you walk around for like your whole life and never have had stevia? Nastasia, back me up on this.
It's true.
Are you saying, so, okay, my experience of stevia is that I would choose in a coffee shop to put it in things. You're telling me that it's in like packaged goods that I might buy off the...
No, someone at some point in your life, someone's handed you something, you've tasted it and been like, what is that? And they're like, that's stevia.
Well, okay, then I didn't know that that was the horrible, but I do remember spitting that drink out. It was really bad.
Okay. So anyway, listen, the trick when you're working with any sort, so sugar, sucrose, table sugar, right, has a number of different functions. So one of them obviously is sweetness. And the thing about sucrose is that of all of the sweetness things that you can do, get, use, it is the cleanest. Clean, right? Almost every other sweetener, either like a you know, natural or artificial, has some form of bitterness. Excuse me. some form of alternate flavor. It's not kind of pure, clean sweetness. So there's that. You're almost always dealing with like flavors that go along with it. So you can either use those flavors to your advantage or not, right? And when something has what is in general considered to be an off-putting taste, so I, you know, stevia. I mean, you're being very kind to it by saying licorice. It's got like kind of, to me, kind of like kind of bitter metallic notes in it that I find unpleasant. And by the way, you should test that with other people because not everyone has the same, especially to things that have bitterness in them. Bitterness has a much wider range, not just of perception in the terms of strength. Like, so with sugar, people are like, that's too sweet or that's too dry. The same person could think that one thing is too sweet and then another person could think it's not sweet enough, but they both kind of agree on what sweetness is. With bitterness, it's not just a level of bitterness, but like some people, like for instance, I am don't have a strong reaction to Prop, the bitter thing that they do when they test to see if you're a super taster or not, right? Where someone else sees that as intensely bitter, right? I think that broccoli rabe is bitter, but not intensely bitter. And there's other bitter compounds that maybe I perceive more than, let's say, you do. So whenever you're dealing with something that has bitter notes, you want to make sure that you test it with a wide range of people, right? So so you have that. So any alternative sweetener is going to have these off notes. Now, something similar to what people do when they're kind of compounding gluten-free flours is instead of just using one thing to replace wheat flour, they use a range of things. And they hope that by averaging this range of things that you're not going to notice the extreme beany taste of, let's say, black-eyed pea flour or whatever, right? Because you're not going to notice kind of like the textural hit you take if you use pure rice. So they average a lot of things together by using these blends. And that's one of the reasons you see kind of these blends in gluten-free flours. And the same is true for sweeteners, right? So you might want to look into other diabetic-friendly sweeteners, non-caloric sweeteners, like, for instance, monk fruit. Now, I happen to like the sweetness of monk fruit. It comes with other flavors, but to me, those other flavors aren't gross. They're tea-like, right? So if you have any sort of affinity for like Chinese herbal teas, right, then you will like monk fruit, or there's a bunch of different, you know, Mormortica, what is it? I forget the actual title, the actual, you know, name of it. But so if you look at that, you'll see that like that has sweetness and some other flavors. So maybe a combination of stevia and monk fruit can help tamp down some of those notes that when you use stevia only for the sweetness. Now, the second problem with preservation, so this is some experiments that I would really like to run for various reasons, right? But when you want to do a lemon juice and you want it to keep for a long time, I think the best thing to do is to make a cordial with it, right? So you clarify it. And yes, I think you should buy a Spinzol to clarify it, or, you know, whatever centrifuge you're going to use, but whatever, you don't have to. You can do freeze thaw, you could do quick agar, you could do any of these things because it's not going to be fresh, right? But now then when you make a cordial, you save the peels, you boil the peels with the juice, the clarified juice, and sugar, right? Now, and then it becomes stable. So the sugar makes it stable because, you know, it's now at a simple syrup level and it's not going to kind of spoil, especially with the sugar and the acidity. The problem is it, and the taste stays relatively stable for a long time, like months. The problem is, and it tastes good, is I don't know if the sugar is necessary to the process. So it's pretty simple test. It's just I haven't had the time to run it, of just boiling the clarified juice on its own without the sugar, right? And seeing whether or not I get the same stability, whether the reactions are the same that give that same stability. If it's just the heat that's necessary, well, then you could just use boiled clarified lemon juice as your lemon in it. And it's not going to taste like fresh lemon, right? But especially with the peel, it'll have the notes of a good cordial, which are delicious, but not the same as fresh. What do you guys think? Does this make sense?
Yep.
All right. Hey, Nastasia, Dave, and Matt in the booth. If, in fact, you are still in a booth, but we already addressed this, right? this person accuses you, Micah in Minnesota, Matt, accuses you of being Matt on the couch.
I'm not on the couch. That's a dirty lie.
All right.
I'm in a regular chair. I'm sorry. It's not an impressive place to be.
Well, again, for all we know you're a liar, so you may be on a couch. You may be on a couch in your chonies because you're a well-known liar. You've lied to everything, us about the stevia.
Everything. I'm sipping on my stevia drink right now.
I know it.
It is a gurgling stevia. Love it.
I know. It's just going, wow, so weird. Anyway, hope you're doing well and staying safe in these crazy times. Dave, you recently addressed someone's question regarding culturing cream to make butter and said that one should use buttermilk and not yogurt. Why is that? I know buttermilk is traditional slash standard, but there are other options. I've used yogurt quite successfully myself and more experimentally, Koji. By the way, we got to have Rich on soon because his book is probably going to be coming out. And it's a good time for people to be experimenting with Koji at home since everyone's home. Just curious as to why you so firmly recommend buttermilk. Thanks for continuing to put on the show, Micah in Minnesota. Well, Micah, you're right. I mean, like, I just recommend it because it's traditional, and I'm a huge believer in experimenting. So experiment with whatever you want. You're totally right, I think. But if you want more of a traditional cultured butter flavor, and by the way, John, for those of you that don't know, John was the source of all my recommendations in Belgium. So because of his recommendations of where to go, is why I own the HVD A57 Liège waffle maker. It's why I have a stockpile of the world's greatest mustard from Ghent in my fridge right now. So John might have some opinions on culture. Yeah, yeah, Nastasia, you love that mustard too, right?
Yeah, but I don't know what to put it on now that I'm not eating meat.
Cheese.
Really?
Yeah. It's great on cheese. So this mustard, by the way, is made only with mustard seed, brown mustard seed, water, vinegar, and salt, and that's it. That's it, right? So it's all about the kind of purity of the thing. And so I got back from the museum. We'll talk more about the museum and COVID in a second, but I got back from the museum my wet grinder. And so as soon as John and I are allowed to hang out in the same room together, we are going to take on for Cooking Issues listeners the task of recreating the Ghent mustard.
And why would you do that? It's like,
because you can't go get it.
Yeah, but like, okay.
What do you mean? Why would you try to make something that you love? Why would you try to make it? Why would you try to make something that you really want to have but can't get?
I feel
that this is surprising.
I would be like, Nastasia, if you said, why are you learning to make Twinkies? I'd say, you're right. I can just go to the store and buy Twinkies.
But I'm saying, like, it's almost insulting because these people, like, it's their life's work. And you're like, I'm just going to do it and hopefully I get it right. And, you know.
Is that what I said? I'm just going to do it and hope I get it right.
I would rather.
Or did I say that I have a wet grinder and I've been thoroughly researching the technology of mustard making?
Just go to Belgium every year and get it. That would be like the amount of time, which is money, that you're going to spend trying to recreate this is probably about the same as a flight to Belgium.
Well, listen. I mean, like, in between getting my monocle repaired and like going to my, you know, cigar shop, I will plan my yearly trip to Ghent so that I can pick up a jar of mustard. I'll have the plane land in Ghent. I'll have my driver go get the mustard while I wait and eat tea sandwiches in my Learjet, Stas. Or I'll learn how to make mustard. Anyway.
Yeah, one of those suggestions is reasonable. We got about 10 minutes to go.
This is Prashant from Florida. I have a question on how to store fresh-made pasta. I thought you'd enjoy this, Nastasia. Because you hate fresh-made pasta. Yeah. Hey, the one of them's gnocchi. That was the one you said maybe was different.
Potato.
Currently, I make the pasta and freeze it overnight and then throw them frozen into the boiling water. But the two times I did this with both fettuccine and gnocchi, the pasta ends up sticking and becoming a massive clump while cooking. The fettuccine got stuck because of the way I put it in the freezer. He did the nests. I think it's a he. Prashant, yeah. He did the Ness, right? Mm-hmm. But I was more careful with the gnocchi and spaced them out to make sure they did not stick. I had similar results both times. So what's the best way to store pasta to prevent it from sticking? Also, can I freeze leftover pasta dough for later? I mean, it's low moisture, probably. I also have some bread making questions, so please let me know when Leahy is going to be on the air. I didn't want to get the questions mixed up. Okay, so I don't have a lot of experience freezing fresh pasta, but I
fresh pasta and then that's it, and then make it again, and then make it again. Why do you have to freeze it?
Because it's easier to make more than you need for one night and freeze it.
Right, whatever.
Oh, says the lady who had a whole business built around freezing pasta.
That was dry pasta. Fresh pasta is not supposed to be frozen.
It wasn't, but yours was a completely different from that. You were par cooking and freezing and IQFing, right?
We had one fresh pasta that was frozen, and again, a technique that took decades to get down, and that's the secret. And I don't know how they did it, but
what kind of fresh pasta was it?
It was the fettuccine.
And did you have any problems with it sticking?
No, but again, because these people worked for decades on how to do it right, and they are not telling anybody.
Yeah. Okay. Fine. Listen, I'll tell you, like, the way that smaller companies, like for instance, DiPaolo's, when they freeze their pasta, they either use like a dusting of very coarse semolina, or they use a cornmeal, depending on which one they're doing. On, for instance, their ravioli, they dust that stuff with that, so that when it's in the freezer and it's single layer, right? So it's single layer and it's like coated with that stuff so that it won't stick to each other. The theory, I guess, being that as long as it's frozen fast enough and you're not getting a lot of moisture migration out, those little things act like BBs or ball bearings and get it. But that's not going to help you with fettuccine. That might help you with the gnocchi. But you're really, I mean, the problem with gnocchi too is that, I mean, I don't know about you, but you're freezing it before you boil it, or you're going to parboil it and then reboil it when you're done. I mean, there's going to be a lot of issues with moisture migration. So if you keep everything completely separate on a tray, give it a little bit of some ball bearings to roll around with, and then hard freeze it. What I'm thinking is that when you're repackaging them into servings, you're letting them, what's the word I'm looking for? You're letting them kind of thaw a little bit. And if there's any sort of thaw, you're going to get moisture migration. They're going to stick together unless you've got the little BBs to separate them. BBs meaning stuff like cornmeal or semolina. But then on a fettuccine, that's going to ruin the texture of it if you have these kind of coarse garbages sticking around. Don't you think, Nastasia?
Yeah.
So I don't know how you're going to do it with here's what you do. I think also you're putting your fettuccine in way too wet. So you want to lay your fettuccine out on one of those drying things, like, you know, and then wait until it's just at the point where if you were going to bend it, it would snap. Like just before then, when the outside's real kind of hard, not hard, but like really, you know, almost semi-dry, then you could nest it and freeze it. And I don't think the fettuccine is going to stick together. But I think you're not waiting long enough before you you do it. What do you think, Stas? You don't care. You don't want to give any advice because you're like, you should spend your whole life working on it.
Yeah.
Or this guy just wants to make some freaking fettuccine.
Great. Make it, cook it, make it, cook it. Make it.
That's not the question. Make it, make it, make it. Now, we can all agree that Big Night's a great movie, can't we?
Yeah.
That's what I should be watching while quarantined. Oh.
You should watch Big Night. For anyone that has not seen Big Night, you need to stop what you're doing. You've already listened to enough of us for the day. Go watch it. It's Tucci and Shalhoub. And isn't Isabella Rossellini in it? There's all kinds of it's an amazing show. It's an amazing show. And Tony Shalhoub plays the older brother, who's kind of like the younger brother's the boss, right? And they have this Italian restaurant in where is it? Somewhere on the East Coast. And Tony Shalhoub only wants to make stuff that's true to his roots. That's all he cares about. He doesn't want to make Americanized 50s like food, right? And so like this person asks for, what do they ask for? Someone asks for like cheese on their seafood risotto, or so someone else asks for like starch on, like one starch on top of another starch, like they wanted like risotto and pasta. And Shaloub's like, I won't do it. And Tucci comes in, and this is where Nastassia gets, and I both do this all the time. Tucci just goes into him and goes, make it, make it, make it, because just make what the customer wants. Make it, make it. It's like, it's just a fantastic, fantastic movie for anyone that, loves food or loves Tucci or Shaloub or loves sticking to your guns even when it hurts. Right, Stas?
Yep.
Classics. Great movie. Classics in the movie field. John, you've seen that movie, right?
Yeah, yeah. Not in a while, but I've seen it.
Do you also like it or no?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Didn't dislike it. Yeah.
Didn't dislike it.
Oh, my God.
One more thing. So we got... We'll do this next time. Someone sent in from Yahoo Mail, wants to know more, Red Liquid Intelligence. I don't have the name of the person who wrote it in, but wants us to talk more about the spins all on the air. I'm happy to do that. We should have a, Stas, like you and I should talk about things to do with centrifuges maybe next week as like a whole section.
People wanted a demo on the Instagram Live with that, so maybe we could do that too.
Yeah. By the way, if you have any spins all questions, John's going to be your go-to person for the customer for customer service, right? Also,
and
Andy,
John, as in jeans. But you know, we should also just get John@bookerandax.com because no one's listening to me probably. So that if they email John@bookerandax.
Oh yeah. By the way, so back when MoFad had two Johns working, we had John Hutt, who we called John the Hutt. And John, who you're now listening to, whose name is spelled Gene, but it's pronounced John, so we would call him Gene John. But I don't think he enjoyed that, Nastassia. Am I right, John?
Well, I'm just saying we should get that email address from him because you know that people are stupid, and so they're going to email John@bookerandax. So
I hope you guys enjoy that. Nastassia just called you stupid. It's J-E-A-N.
Why not? Why not filter all the John, the J-O-H-Ns right to the trash as well?
No, because then you're going to get bad reviews and Twitter comments saying, John never answered me. I mean, I know people will be
done. So it's J-E-A-N@bookerandax.com. Yeah, yeah, that's J-E-A-N@bookerandax.com. All right. So we have a question about cooking, like vacuum sealing cooking proteins, which I guess we can handle that next time if you want. And also
email me and let us know if you liked our Instagram Live or what you would change during.
The person who wants us to talk more about spinzols put as a side note, they had been making black garlic in an Excalibur, and they were also heat aging garum in an Excalibur, which is the dehydrator that we use. At 141 degrees Fahrenheit, and they insulated it because it was in their garage. But they used this is an interesting fact because I've always wondered. They ran it for 10 weeks solid, and it used 182 kilowatt hours of power. Now, in New York State, at our current electricity price, that is $30 or $3 a week. So if you want to know how much it's costing you to run and you live in New York and pay New York electricity prices, if you want to know how much it's costing you to run an Excalibur dehydrator day and night, it's about $3 a week, which I thought was interesting. To me anyway, only to me. Yeah. See, John, that's why I like having you on, because Nastassia doesn't care. You care about things like this. See what I mean? All right. So time for classics in the field, yeah. All right, now we have. Listen, I might do this because I was looking through my books, and I have many books, not as many as I would like, but you know, I haven't been buying books heavy for like well over a decade, just because my apartment is pretty full. But I love books. We should actually have people send in like their suggestions for books that we should look at or get. Anyway. But I realize that I have two categories of books that are classics. One are, well, I have many, but the two that I'm going to talk about today are books that I think people might actually want to look at. And then books that are classics, like, for instance, Kant's Critique of Judgment, that no one is ever going to want to read. So I thought I'd talk briefly about both kinds. And so for the first one, I'm going to talk about a book that came out that if you looked at it nowadays, you would say, oh, you know, yeah, I've seen a million books like that. But when this book came out, there was nothing like that. So, and also anyone who is listening who is familiar with culture in the United Kingdom, this is going to be a very well-known person and book, but not so much in the United States. And so, for instance, John, what do you know about Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall? Anything? A lot?
I love it. Yeah.
You love it, right? But why is he – so he is a celebrity chef in England. And he owns a place called The River Cottage and has a series of TV shows and books. And the first one came out in 2001 called The River Cottage Cookbook. And complete revelation. Now, for some reason, not as famous in the U.S. Why, John? Why is he not as famous in the U.S.? Even for British standards, like we got your Ramsays over here. We got your, you know, your Olivers over here. Even your Heston Blumenthal's over here. But not a lot of people know about the Whittingstall here. Why do you think that is?
I really have no idea. It doesn't make any sense because his meat book is one of the best books out there. I love like the little mini series of books on making alcohol or prosciutto or, you know, dry aging hams or on herbs or things like that. I don't know. Like the whole River Cottage, everything is great. He needs to be more popular here.
By the way, a friend of the show, Naomi Devlin, wrote the River Cottage gluten-free book and is a member of kind of that collective. So shout out to her. So I had no idea who this guy was. Now you got to remember he's famous before he had the River Cottage. He did, and has done over the years, a bunch of kind of crazy publicity stunts in the UK. So in like 97, I think 1997 or 98 on TV, he cooked a woman's placenta and served it at a party to her friends and family and kind of, let's just say people in the UK, you know, famously buttoned up people in the UK, not too pleased by this. You know what I mean? By the kind of like the placenta-rama. And this was before kind of there was that like, thank God, short-lived thing where people were making cheese out of human breast milk. Not because there's anything wrong with it, just because it's such a precious commodity that to make cheese out of it seems incredibly disrespectful. But for those of you that, you know, have been around having to, you know, get that for kids, it's like the idea of using it for cheese is just, to me, bananas. But anyway, so he cooked up this placenta, had a huge thing. More recently, like in the 2010 or 2011, I think he cooked dog on the air. Because he was trying to show how hypocritical it is that we won't eat things like dogs, but we will eat things like pigs. So he's done a lot of things that are kind of on the edge that way, provocative, shall we say. But in the late 90s, he bought this place, the River Cottage. And in 2001, I think right around when the show was coming out or maybe even before, he came out with the first of the River Cottage cookbooks. And at the time, when you look at it, I have the first English edition of it. So did they ever publish that one in the U.S., the original River Cottage has a U.S. edition? Do you know?
I don't think so, but I'm not 100% sure.
So anyway, I have the original U.K. edition of it. And when this book came out, I saw it used at the Strand. So I used to, Strand's a used cookbook store in New York City. And I used to troll it just looking for books back when everything there, they weren't searching prices on the internet. So everything was just half off the whatever the cover price was. So I think I paid $10 for it. And it was only probably a year or two old when I got it. And the book itself was a complete revelation. First of all, no one at that time had done this kind of like back to simple thing. So he's predating when what's his name? Pollen became food Jesus and talked about everyone going simple on everything. He predated a lot of that. And it is true that he comes from a rich family of landed gentry. His mom is a famous like flower designer who's won all these awards at the Chelsea Flower Show, right? So, you know, yes, it's a rather elitist thing for him to say you can go back to nature and raise your own pigs and do all, and, you know, the quote unquote simpler life, which is, you know, obviously something that only someone with a good deal of privilege can do nowadays. But man, was he good at it, right? So first of all, when you look at his books, like he had that kind of blown out color, like kind of a, you know, the matte paper before it became popular. This was before, like, you'd see those kind of shots in Dave Chang's cookbook when it made a huge splash, like shots of like the dirty radishes that he's grown, you know, at the cottage, like just these kind of like reality, like natural light shots, the kind of paper, the look, the feel, all amazing. Recipes also good. And the reason I bought the book at the Strand is he had a series of pigs he raised. And he had a picture of this pig outside running around doing piggy things. And over it in white lines, he had drawn the cuts that he was going to cut the pig into after he slaughtered it on the image of the live pig. And when I saw that in the Strand, I was like, oh my God, oh Jesus. And I bought it immediately. I became a huge instant fan of this guy's work. So like, it is impossible to imagine today's cookbooks, the way they look. I guess an early also kind of, although it was, I think, black and white, is Cooking by Hand had that matte paper back in the day. But a very early harbinger of kind of the way food styling, cookbooks, and kind of the mentality around a return to old style ingredients would look today. You can see it in 2001 in the River Cottage Cookbook. So please try to look at it with the eyes of someone from 20 years ago. Then the second, real quick, because no one's going to want to spend that much time with it. If you really like dry academic books that have had a huge influence on thought and culture, yet literally like 10 people have maybe read it, check out Steven Nissenbaum's 1980 or 1981 classic, Sex, Diet, and Debility in Jacksonian America. Now, before 1980, right, Sylvester Graham of Graham Cracker fame, right, and kind of Graham bread fame, was a very fringe historical figure that not a lot of people had paid attention to. But and since that time, it's almost impossible, since Steven Nissenbaum wrote this book, it's almost impossible to talk about a history of fad dieting, nutrition, kind of the link between thoughts on food, sexuality, morality, and physical decline, right? It's almost impossible to talk about the history of that in America without talking about Sylvester Graham. And the whole reason for it is this one book, Sex, Diet, and Debility in Jacksonian America, where Nissenbaum draws the link, right, between Sylvester Graham, this famous Philadelphia physician, Benjamin Rush, and ideas that happened just prior to the American Revolution in France, and the entire shift of a culture where it used to be, if you wanted to feel strong, you did things that were robust. If you wanted to feel strong, you ate things that were strong, kind of an additive effect to this idea that human beings have only a certain amount of energy, and that by, for instance, overextending your sexual energy would cause you to decline and die. All of these kinds of crazy conservation that we only have a certain amount of stuff and you have to be careful about what you consume in that way really stems from this era in American culture. And this book really points out, connects a lot of the dots that are now seen as kind of just, yeah, everybody knows that. But before this person wrote this book, it was kind of hard to connect those dots. So if you really want to get an idea of how we got to the way we think today about kind of food and health, right? Which I think is an incredibly fraught subject. We can do an entire cooking issues on that someday if you want. Go and check out, although I know you won't, Sex, Diet, and Debility in Jacksonian America by Steven Nissenbaum. What do you guys think? You've read that one, John?
I have not.
Great book.
Give it a go.
Fantastic. If you like dry historical things, fantastic. Deserves to be more widely credited if not read. Anyway, and we'll get to the questions on vacuum packing and other things next week. Tune in, by the way, to the MoFed. Also, our love out to all of the people dealing, obviously, like we're all dealing with it, but Corona, people. I wish people would write in, let us know how they're doing. Let us know how they're doing. I mean, I know it's tough. We didn't talk about it today. I was going to talk about the incentives and how they relate to the incentives that just came out yesterday and the day before and how they relate to the restaurant industry. But maybe I'll wait a week to see how they are actually going to shake down. But I know that you guys are all at home right now instead of doing what you want to be doing, which is cooking for other people and hanging out with other people. So I hope you can stay strong. I hope you can spend some time learning things that you wouldn't otherwise be able to learn when you're at work, either whether it's recipes, whether it's techniques, whether it's, you know, whatever, math, philosophy. Hopefully you can put this time to good use if you can't be out actually helping people or doing things. Anyway, stay strong. Cooking Issues.
Cooking Issues is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.